Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to The Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm Marcello Rolando. The mission of The Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing the creative artist and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, and this is the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. My guest today, author Ashley Warner, who is the author of the critically acclaimed The Year After, a rape memoir about healing after such trauma. Hello, Ashley. How are you today?
Hi, Marcello. I'm great. Thanks for having me on today.
Good. Now, Ashley, you're also a psychotherapist, yes?
That's right.
And this came after the event?
It did. I was a young actress in New York 23 years ago during the time of my sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
And in the aftermath and part of my healing process, I went to therapy and worked on recovering from the crisis and the rape, obviously, and then continued on afterwards and found it really a really fulfilling experience.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came time for me to make a career change, I studied and became a therapist myself.
Yes. And you were based out of New York, but at the end of September, you were in Virginia for a couple of, in North Carolina, I believe, for a couple of speaking engagements.
I was. I have become an accidental advocate.
Yes.
Against sexual violence from the book. I've worked against sexual violence for a long time, my entire psychotherapy career, the past 15 years, including speaking and teaching about sexual violence. But that role has really expanded since I wrote the book, and I'm really honored to have the opportunity to speak out about sexual violence and about helping people understand how to heal from it and help others heal from it. And I was down in Charlottesville and in North Carolina for a few speaking engagements this past September. It's true.
So how are your audiences responding to your coming forward in a book as well as face-to-face speaking to them? I presume there's a Q&A?
Yeah, the book has been really well received. I'm really proud and pleased. I've heard from survivors who have contacted me to let me know that the book has provided comfort, which is certainly the main reason I wrote the book, and it's inspired a lot of discussion and has really been a useful teaching tool. And so at these talks specifically, the Q&As were full of fantastic questions about what sexual assault is and how to help other people and the prevalence of it and myths about it. And people are really receptive to talking about it and wanting to learn about it. Of course, it's more challenging. The people that we want to engage in talks about sexual violence aren't always necessarily the people who would self-select to come to a lecture about sexual violence.
Yes.
So it's always a matter of working to widen the participation by the community, because sexual violence is a community issue. It's not
yes.
an individual issue. It impacts us all, you know, in one way or another.
Your lectures or Q&A, your speaking engagements are the mission to inspire constructive public communication on something that otherwise people might not talk about openly and freely and yet
Absolutely.
Suffer from.
Yeah, and And, you know, it's a hot topic these days. I mean, sexual violence has been around since the dawn of time. We all know very well that it's been a weapon of war globally since time, you know, before time. And but there's a lot of outrage lately, as we all may be aware as well, specifically on campuses, college campuses, the incidence of sexual violence has really come to the attention more broadly of us all in the United States. And it's an opportunity to use this increased interest in the problem and to be able to talk about it. So I'm glad to, you know, help the discussion along.
Yes, especially I imagine as a psychoanalyst and therapist, you have a lot to give. You mentioned college campuses, and of course we are, I mean, I lived in New York City for 25 years and also was an actor on soaps and a director in theater and so forth. And I, you know, I've always heard stories about how dangerous it is to live in New York, and I never had any problems like that of any kind. I knew plenty of people who had been assaulted on the streets of one way or another, but I now do radio in Charlottesville, Virginia, primarily, and what's going on in Charlottesville is a lot of college situations, the University of Virginia and others. High school student has gone missing in Nelson County and has not been found. We've just recently discovered human remains that everyone's assuming is Hannah Graham, who's been missing for over 5 weeks. What is it behind this sort of thing? As you say, it's been since the beginning of time, but what is going on? Are we just more aware or need to be more aware?
Well, I think a little bit of both. The typical traditional view of sexual violence is that it is perpetrated by a stranger in a dark alley by a man in a ski mask. And that happens sometimes. I mean, that's my story. I was raped by a stranger who jumped out from underneath the staircase in my building. And, you know, and it's true, big cities can be violent, but everywhere in the United States, the prevalence of sexual violence is about 1 in 6 women and 1 in 5 women on college campuses is quoted as being the most recent statistic. And one reason that is because everywhere it's 18 to 24-year-old women who are the most vulnerable population to sexual violence. So obviously when you have a concentrated population of that age group, there's going to be higher instances of sexual violence. And thanks to the foundational work of anti-sexual violence professionals that over the last 20 years or so who began researching sexual violence, most specifically with the implementation of the Violence Against Women Act that was introduced, we've begun to accumulate some useful research about what sexual violence looks like and who perpetrates it. And come to find out, the majority of sexual violence is perpetrated by someone known to the victim.
Yes.
2/3 of the time is perpetrated by someone known to the victim. 38% of the time by a friend or acquaintance. So that has implications for how we prevent sexual violence, how we talk to people to protect ourselves about sexual violence. It has reverberations through the whole process.
And in addition to obviously the physical healing and recovery, there is an emotional journey that has to be made. How do you advise people about that journey?
Well, there's in the immediate aftermath of sexual trauma, I will recommend that everyone have attend to your physical health. Go to a hospital, go to an emergency room, get a rape kit, make sure that you're physically healthy.
Uh-huh.
The emotional piece of it is indeed a journey. In the immediate aftermath, it's very common to be confused and disoriented, to have your narrative of what happened be interrupted. You might remember some things, but not everything of the sexual assault, and you might remember later other things and forget other things. You can have disturbed sleep. You might blame yourself and feel a lot of doubt about what happened, even in the immediate aftermath. Even in my case, when it's pretty clear these days to everyone, everybody that when you're raped by a stranger, that it's pretty cut and dry. The only thing you have to prove is that, you know, that a rape happened and that you didn't know each other, and it's pretty clear that a sexual violence occurred. When it's someone you know, it's a lot more complicated because you have to prove that there was no consent. So that's a different issue. But the point I was making now is that even in cases of clear-cut, if you will, sexual violence like mine, it is very common to have doubt and self-blame, as I did in the aftermath. This is what you're struggling with immediately, in shock. And, you know, and that can linger for months. You know, as I've talked about in the year after in my book, I was kind of in this suspended state for months after my sexual assault, and people kept telling me, my gosh, you're doing so well, you're doing amazing, and I thought, am I doing amazing? I don't feel anything. And sure enough, when the numbness began to wear off and the feeling started to come in, I was not doing okay. But unfortunately, that's also when a lot of people turn away, thinking that you are doing fine and that the worst is over.
What's
the crisis phase?
What is the worst reaction, at least verbally, that you receive from well-meaning people, I'm sure, friends, family, but when you're going through this phase of still recovery, physically, emotionally, psychologically, and as you say, mentally, there are mixed up memories and everything is traumatized. The entire psyche is traumatized. It's not just one piece of the person, but what are some of the more damaging things you would warn families and friends not to do or not to say to someone who's been sexually assaulted?
I think the most damaging thing you can say is, try not to think about it, honey, or it's over now, just let's move on. Those are indeed, as you point out, often from well-meaning people who don't want to see you suffering anymore, but it invalidates the very natural, normal, and even healthy experience a survivor has of trying to put everything together and of being devastated. When such an assault happens on your body, mind, and soul, it is a very, you know, normal, understandable, and reasonable reaction to feel devastated and to try to make sense of it. You know, that's how the body and psyche heals, by going over it and over and over it and trying to make sense of it. So you're going to want to hear from those who love you, ideally, that they understand that this is really devastating. And of course, you're spending a lot of time thinking about it, and of course you feel hurt, and of course you feel rage, and to really validate and normalize some of these reactions rather than trying to skip over them.
We know your rape occurred at 24, age 24, but how soon after that were you able to start writing the book? It must have been a journey to get from that point to even starting to write a book about, even though the book is primarily about the recovery and healing still.
I had the idea for the year after, a true story, it was about 6 months into my recovery, and I was in the middle of a rage storm, screaming into pillows and pounding the sofa. And I had this moment of clarity that this would make a great book, because that is something I could not find in the literature when I went searching for comfort, as everyone I have ever met does. You know, you go looking for stories that mirror your experience to help you out, to give you some guidance as a beacon of light. And I found a lot of great survivors' stories and some healing materials. But what I didn't find is a book that reported the day-to-day ups and down roller coaster trauma of what it's really like in the aftermath. And, you know, so that's the book I thought, that's what's missing. But of course, I was in the middle of healing myself, and that was not the time to write a book. But what I did did do is keep a journal about the ups and downs. And that journal followed me for, 20 years. And I would pull it out of the drawer every now and then and try to fashion it into a story. And it wasn't time yet for a long time because I was too triggered by it.
Of course.
And then I didn't write it because I was too busy in my life with other things, and it moved on and really didn't want to do it.
Yes.
And then I was in a writing workshop a few years back and thought, let me try again. And it began to take shape into the year after.
And
so, near 20 years for me to write the book.
Wow. Wow, yes. And it's got to be extremely helpful for those who read it or hear about it from you and such radio shows as this. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back. We're speaking with Ashley Warner, who was a victim of sexual assault and lived through it, has become a psychotherapist and psychoanalyst, and she has written the critically acclaimed The Year After. It is a rape memoir that gets us what we're talking about in the next segment, from anger and hopelessness to recovery. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Fed Up came into and out of the movie theater so fast, you might think that film distributors had been pressured to get it out of circulation before the public had a chance to see and react to it. Still, for anyone concerned about the long-term health of American children, Fed Up is a must-see film. For anyone interested in the growing epidemic of obesity in America, Fed Up is a must-see film. And for anyone wanting to understand why losing weight is virtually an impossible task in our culture, Fed Up is a must-see film. Its message is that the Food and Drug Administration, the medical community, and thousands of individual experts have been giving us exactly the wrong information about what will keep us healthy. And they have been persuaded to do so by the packaged food industry. No one wants to believe in a vast conspiracy, not really, but the researched facts assembled for this documentary speak otherwise. Diet and exercise don't really count for much at all, say the filmmakers, not while we are being sabotaged by the excess sugar that permeates virtually all packaged foods. Don't believe it? Watch Fed Up, and then decide for yourselves whether you can safely ignore it. Fed Up, not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Find us on the web at IndieFilmMinute.com.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. My guest today, Ashley Warner, the author of The Year After, a rape memoir that has received the 2014 Reviewer's Choice Award. And we were about to enter into, we've talked about what Ashley went through at 24 and that it took 20 years to be able to even write the book. But now let's talk about, I know for a while you were involved in the criminal prosecution of rapists and identified your own. Was that an sort of interim career, or was that just to solve your case?
Well, actually, in a very rare example, most rapists do not serve time. Only about 3% of rapists ever see a day in jail. That's partly because very few rape cases are reported. Only about 40% are reported. On college campuses, that number is even lower. It's about 12% report.
Wow.
And then of those, many are difficult to get a case together and don't even make it through the system. So at the end of things, only about 3% of rapists serve a day in jail. I am one of those rare victims who saw her rapist prosecuted, sentenced. And that actually did happen throughout that year after. My rapist was caught very early on, just a few weeks after it happened to me. Typical of the profile of a sexual predator. He was a serial rapist.
Yes.
And there had been other victims, both in the time around when I was victimized and also in his past history. So they taught somebody very quickly, and I identified, well, I might have identified, I participated in a lineup.
Yes.
And I appeared before the grand jury twice to mm-hmm. offer my testimony about what happened, and he was about coming up on the year anniversary of my sexual assault, he was sentenced.
Wow.
Yeah.
I guess that's even that in itself, I mean, it's a good thing, but it's like a, I don't know, it's a strange way. I guess it gives you both avenues for remembering the date. I know that sounds, I don't mean that to sound, I certainly don't mean it to sound insensitive. It's just that the two things happening so close to the same date seem, maybe that's the normal order of things. I don't know. But let's get to this from anger and hopelessness to recovery. We should mention that some men are also raped, but by and large, it is women who are raped and young women on college campuses who do not, for their own reasons, understandably, report it. And the recovery process takes a toll and takes time. Ashley and I have spoken a few times, but in between those conversations, life, of course, is going on and things are happening in other parts of the world and other parts of this country and to women. And particularly lately, as I've mentioned, we may have caught a serial rapist. There seems to be developing evidence in Charlottesville, Virginia, that the accused is involved with more than just the disappearance of Hannah Graham. What happens, Ashley, to you when you hear those, especially since you were recently, as I said earlier, September 23rd, you were speaking on this very subject in University of Virginia. What happens when you hear these stories?
It's always disturbing, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
It is always disturbing to hear of a tragic event like, you know, the one going on in Charlottesville. It was very palpable in the air when I was there. It had just recently happened. And it's tragic, and my heart goes out to the families and who have gone through such a thing. And I'm also happy that there is outrage and discussion about it.
Yes.
I mean, the like really digging deep for a silver lining here.
Yes, I understand.
But the good news is that there is more discussion than ever about sexual violence and what to do about it.
Yes.
There is a lot of resistance that we are up against about sexual violence that is perpetrated most of the time in these non-stranger rape cases.
Yes.
That's currently our biggest challenge. It is psychologically, for one reason that it's hard to take in, is that it's psychologically very frightening for us all.
Yes.
To come to grips with the fact that rapes are, and sexual violence is perpetrated by people in our social circles.
Yes.
That we know, that we run into and interact with in our daily lives. It's a lot safer to think it's the stranger on the, you know,
yes,
the bushes.
Yes.
So there's a lot of resistance to recognizing really what we're up against, and that accounts for some of the victim blaming and the tendency to grill a victim who has made a report as opposed to get to the investigation.
Yes.
About what really happened.
I have to say, if there's, you're right, certainly, and again, I've always, every conversation you and I have had, I've been moved, I've been disturbed, I've been inspired by your healing and your teaching the healing process to others. But between each of those conversations, as I said, things happen, and I am a news reporter, and I've had to report on almost daily basis about Hannah Graham. But if we're looking for a half full glass or silver lining anywhere, as you say, it's kind of difficult to grasp in the heat of the moment. But what has happened in as a result of people like you telling their story and a book like The Year After and visiting campuses and making people have constructive conversations, public conversations about it as you do. Information and education is what helps heal, like you're giving your information. All right. This from anger and hopelessness to recovery. I think that's a quote I got from you in one of our conversations. How does one, as many of us are feeling now in Charlottesville, how does one go from anger and hopelessness to recovery?
Well, it is a process, and I want to emphasize that in my experience, both as a survivor and now someone who has worked for 15 years with other survivors, the only way to heal is to go through it. Mm. There is no jumping around it. And it's a very challenging process, and it's a painful one, because sexual violence rocks the entire foundation of what you know to be safe and true.
Yes.
It brings all of that up into question, and absolutely your whole life is turned topsy-turvy. I think that it's really important that while we, as we were talking about earlier, I think we put our friends and loved ones need to be there for us to validate what we're feeling and empower us rather than try to talk us out of what we're feeling. And I think it's important to, you know, get professionals on board, people who are trained trauma specialists to work with survivors.
Yes.
To facilitate healing. You know, if nobody makes it better, but being in an environment with someone who understands the process can help as someone puts the narrative back together about
yes.
what happened in their lives and be alert to warning signs about depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, suicidality, issues of concern that might come up during that process. And those are all very real long-term potential effects, by the way, of sexual violence if it goes untreated. Survivors are more likely to abuse drugs and alcohol, to contemplate suicide, to suffer from depression, to suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. So bring in the professionals.
Yes.
I also think that when the time is right, a group is a very useful healing tool, a survivors group. I attended a rape survivors group that was absolutely instrumental in healing. It's useful to heal, hear other stories, even though no one's story is exactly alike, and that there is a very broad range of reactions to sexual violence. Even so, there can be a lot of healing and comfort from being around other survivors and sharing stories with each other and people that understand in a way that not everyone does.
Yes. We touched on briefly what to do about going to the police immediately after and the rape kit, etc. We've seen on television shows not to shower before you see the police because you destroy evidence. Is that true, by the way, that particular point?
Absolutely. That's true advice. Yeah. And you can have a rape kit up to 96 hours after an assault. So do go. It's not a pleasant process. And by the way, just because you have a rape kit, a forensic kit done, does not mean that you have to press charges. So even if you're unsure, go have one done. In the long run, when you might care more about justice.
Yes.
Then you will have everything in place, which describes me, by the way. When my rapist was caught, I could have cared less. What justice matter? It's already happened.
Yes.
What do I care? I was ambivalent. But I did it all, and in the end, after I came out of my, numb emotional phase and
yes.
started to care very deeply about what happened, I was very glad to have done all of that, and DNA evidence that was collected was instrumental in, putting my rapist behind bars. And, and that I wanted to say something too, just piggybacking on what you were talking about the suspect you have in custody there in Charlottesville, about the Hannah Graham case.
Yes.
I just wanted to reiterate that putting a rapist behind bars, you are often it was, first of all, the best rape prevention there is, because most rapists are serial offenders and often violent across multiple contexts.
Yes.
So if you've prosecuted a rapist, you have likely done more than, you know, bring justice to one case. You have likely prevented future violence.
Yes.
I just wanted to add that as well. And again, this is part of the healing process too, because as you move ahead in speaking of one's recovery, these things will become more important, you know, as your healing moves from, you know, yourself and you know, growing in back into who you are and who you will become.
Yes.
As a stronger, more empowered person. And these are possible gifts of going through such a trauma. And you can come out the other end really empowered and ready to make a difference. And so this sort of justice and caring about justice is also part of the healing process.
I can understand that. I can also understand how it's not your initial thought. But I appreciate the advice for all women that getting the rape kit and going through that unpleasantness of answering questions and describe you, one day, even though you can't possibly enjoy that as you're going through it or appreciate it even, but one day, as you say, when you've worked your way toward that point, it's still justice waiting there for you when you're ready to pursue that, I guess. How about your medical experiences and are there differences, hospitalization and the staff, whether male doctor or female nurse or whatever, how are rape victims treated these days in a hospital?
Well, I think it all depends on where you go.
Uh-huh.
There is, you know, thanks to, again, the work that has been put in place, is that more and more there are specially trained units to work with sexual violence survivors. In my case, I benefited from state-of-the-art sexual violence training and treatment from mm-hmm. the emergency respondents to the hospital and nursing staff mm-hmm. to the detectives who investigated my case. You know, everyone had special training in how to work with sexual violence victims, and this makes all the difference.
Yes.
You know, as we were talking about earlier, the presentation of someone who has been sexually assaulted does not often look like what the Hollywood movie would have us believe.
Yes.
You know, the victim may be numb and spaced out, confused, full of self-doubt and blame. Her testimony may be halting,
yes.
And it may appear, if you don't know what you're looking at, like a false report. So it's really important, I think, for everyone along the way to be alert that the presentation that might to someone untrained look like a false report is actually more of a confirmation, if anything, or certainly a hint that sexual violence might actually indeed have taken place.
Yes.
So, you know, quite the opposite than what it would appear.
That takes us back to the importance of a book like The Year After, and it's in igniting public constructive conversation. I wonder one last question before we go. Is the government at various levels, city, state, county, President Obama, you know, everyone seems to think he's the solution to everything. They either hate him because they accuse him of trying to do too much, or they, you know, complain that he isn't. But he gets blamed for a lot of things. But I wonder, I know you've told me about it's on us. I remember that talk that he was talking to the men and how, especially young men, but to all men, and how they treat their wives and how they allow their girlfriends and fiancés and aunts and mothers, even children, to be treated. How do you feel about, is there a proactive initiative coming from D.C. or Albany or wherever in your experience?
Well, the White House formed a task force earlier this year
mm-hmm.
To address sexual violence and sexual violence on campus, I believe, in particular.
Yes.
And so the task force was comprised of a lot of sources, including RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, Incest National
Yes.
Network, was on the advisory team. And It's On Us is one of the results of some of the recommendations,
yes.
Which is to involve the community in prevention. You know, as we were talking about earlier, rape is not just for too long, the way to prevent being raped is that, you know,
yes.
We put the onus on the rape victim to not get raped.
Yes, yes.
And it's actually a community issue, and the It's On Us campaign is a way to begin to educate the community that we all have a responsibility to keep our eyes open and to reject behavior, language that is overtly harassment and abusive and misogynistic and promotes rape culture, and to empower the community, especially men, to speak up when
yes.
they don't like something. There's research that shows actually that most men are not comfortable when a woman is being disparaged.
Mm-hmm.
But historically, there's less people speak up about that because they think they're supposed to be, you know, all guys are supposed to really be into that.
But
we need to re-educate
yes.
Everyone that, you know, most people don't like that. It helps disguise rapists
yes.
is what it does. So I think the campaign is definitely a step in the right direction because, you know, anti-sexual violence is not anti-man. Most
yes.
men are not rapists. It's a tiny percentage of men who are responsible for most of the sexual violence. So that's a very unfortunate polarity that exists between, you know, people who are outraged because of false reports of sexual violence, and they should be. That is a terrible, terrible thing, but it's a small percentage of rape reports. And,
yes.
But those people have been pitted against people who are trying to raise awareness about the reality of sexual violence. Actually, those things are the result of the same problem, which is sexual violence that is not investigated properly
yes.
by, you know, correctly trained people. You know, it's the same. It's the root is the same issue. Not,
yes.
They're not different.
So. All right. Okay, then. This has been, as always, Ashley, I've said it before, it's moving, it's disturbing, but it is also enlightening and inspires us to be better people toward one another and to demand that of each other, that we respect everyone and treat them with respect and defend them when necessary. So this has been a great conversation. No matter how disturbing it has been, I am so glad that we have had this conversation with Ashley Warner, the author of The Year After, a rape memoir. I hope you've all learned as much as I have, and we'll look to your communities, to those who have been assaulted, to those who can be of help, and as family and friends, learn what to say and not to say. How's that, Ashley?
Sounds like a good plan, Marcello. Thank you.
Thank you so very much for being on the show, and all the best. And I hope every college campus in this America invites you to speak, because there's too much silence on this issue.
There is. That would be wonderful. Look forward to seeing them.
Thank you, Ashley. Bye now.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Stay with us as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
And now, another film rental discovery. Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. When the setting of a film becomes a character itself, a dimension is added that can become critical to the film. Lars and the Real Girl is the story of a troubled man who falls in love with an anatomically correct, life-size doll. In less discriminating hands, this film could have been tawdry, but here it takes its place among the indie classics. Ryan Gosling plays Lars, a troubled young man who retreats more and more into himself, shunning any human contact. Innately, we know that when love enters his life, it is part of a healing journey, no matter that his love is a mail-order latex doll. Upon its arrival, he immediately begins to open up with a shy smile. At first, everyone else is disturbed, but this is where the town comes in. Surely this tale is an unbelievable conception, but not in this town. Quoting the film, this is a town where when tragedy strikes, they come over and sit. Just sit. They are there for each other, creating a cocoon where one can take the time needed to work through problems,
surrounded by acceptance, warmth, and humor. Lars and the Real Girl is an unbelievable premise that works so surprisingly well. You'll wish that you lived here. Independent film, where the real stories are told. You can find us on the web at www.indiefilmminute.com.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us and becoming one of the reasonable voices heard around the world. Acts of terror, domestic violence, stranger danger, governor redirection. In a Northwest High School cafeteria on the morning of Friday, October 24th, five Marysville Pilchuck students were shot by a 14-year-old. All involved were friends, two even cousins of the assailant. Because one had a gun, one girl lay dead before the homecoming prince shot himself. However, I'm not writing to repeat the obvious regarding an NRA Congress or the open carry distortion of the Second Amendment, nor to dwell on the convenient excuse for gun violence, mental health. I'm writing because none of that seems to matter anymore. Truth is, if the early 2012 Christmas present from handgun lovers like Wayne LaPierre, 26 people, 23 of them elementary school children, gunned down in Sandy Hook Elementary, didn't recalibrate public handgun discipleship, then sadly one dead girl in Marysville Pilchuck High School isn't going to raise a rational eyebrow in a tombstone-oriented Congress, nor enlighten change-resistant political conservatives, or remove the bull's-eye mentality in the marriage between violence and political corruption. Unless, of course, November voters fire with ballots as accurately as we are fired upon with bullets. For weeks, as radio news producer anchor, I have been reporting on the tenacity of Charlottesville Police Chief Tim Longo and the federal, state, county, and city police agencies and volunteers searching for a missing second-year University of Virginia student. Friday, while editing an upcoming Human Rights Blog Talk radio interview, my iPod interrupted to confirm human remains found in Albemarle County, Virginia, Saturday, October 18th, were those of Hannah Graham. In a September 2005 attempted murder, a 26-year-old Fairfax County woman was raped. In 2009, Morgan Harrington was 20. At 17, it was Alexis Murphy in 2013. 24-year-old Yardley Love was murdered in 2010 by an ex-boyfriend. Hannah Graham was 18. Could it be, like our enemies and frenemies, we hold female life less dear? All violence, ISIS, Syria beheadings, Guantanamo waterboarding, shootings in schools and inner streets, hands held high, elevator and home beatings, being killed in the line of duty by sharpshooting survivalists or radicalized Americans. In all violence, women, minorities, children, and elderly are its primary targets. It's shameful enough when NRA's President James W. Potter II leads Congress by the nose at the cost of American life, when a politicized Supreme Court inundates our electoral system with corporatism's financial underbelly while gutting minority voters, when on election days we repeatedly ignore devaluation of the more than 50% of American citizens without a penis and refuse to raise minimum salaries to a livable wage, when Takata's response to mothers driving their children in cars with shrapnel-shooting airbags is to disconnect passenger side airbag and relegate the family to the back seat, when creators of Guantanamo and the Great Recession of 2008 are never prosecuted. But when in 2014 not one Republican member in either House of Congress has agreed to vote in favor of bills currently before them to make American females constitutionally equal to American males, then how can any patriotic American consider putting Mitch McConnell in charge of the U.S. Senate? And when New York and New Jersey governor scandals are camouflaged with inciting further Ebola panic through intimidation of volunteer medical professionals, and we fall for it, we go belly up as a welcome mat on which the old white men of Wall Street and Capitol Hill wipe their feet. Listen. American women, American minorities, and American immigrants matter, and they all contribute to America's success, prosperity, brain trust, and recovery, and yet they're relegated to second-class citizen status. Could it be the Liberty Bell ringing game changer America is really seeking is the legacy of Alice Paul in 1923 and 1972 for equal rights for all? Why don't we elect those who truly value the lives of all Americans enough to preserve, protect, and defend them against all forms of violence? Join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Thank you. And thank you for voting America forward progressively on Tuesday, November 4th, 2014.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of The Reasonable Voice. Voice.com website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.